Well, the first Hoover digger that was brought here was 12 inches wide. And that, at that time, seemed wide enough because we didn't make such big rows. But as the time went on, we enlarged the rows, widened the rows, due to, well, keeping the potatoes from getting sunburned, because we were growing bigger potatoes then, and also to keep the grass down. Well, that took the next move from the 12-inch was up to the 15-inch. Well, as I recall it, that went for a while. But then, about a year to a year after that, the Houghton Foundry developed a two-row outfit on wheels that made it possible to make the rows wider. The hole that they had, you could adjust it so you'd make the row wider. Well, that kind of eliminated the 15-inch digger. Well, then they came back with one, 18.
So that eliminated the 15.
Yeah, that eliminated the 15. Well, then they came back with one 18 inches. Well, then, of course, as we got heavier tractors and all of those, it was to the advantage in many ways to have the wide rows, because we were growing bigger crops and getting bigger potatoes, and some potatoes that grew near the top of the ground, unless we had the big row, they got sunburned. And also, they would go ahead and with these new cultivators and horse hoes, they would tear the row down in the sides what they could, and then build it up again. In that way, they would eliminated a lot of grass and so forth. So the final digger was 18 inches wide.
How many racetracks have there been in Houghton, and why were they located in different places?
The first racetrack that was in Houghton was up on High Street. It was located about opposite the Fair Street Schoolhouse on the other side of the road, in back there. Well, I could just remember when that was there. Well, then, in... Just a minute. This right here. I would say the first racetrack was built around 1900. And in those days, of course, they weren't such good tracks as we had to have later. But I recall when a man by the name of Jeff Bradbury got a trotting horse somewhere, and he went a mile up on that track in 3 minutes. Well, we thought we had the world stopped for racing right there. Well, that track gradually went out of existence. And then my father and Uncle Mel owned this land where our house is here in Bowdoin Street and all through here. And they built a racetrack here, and the grandstand was right where my son Albert's house is, back at the edge of the grove. And north of that, in back a ways, was endless stalls for racehorses and cattle and so forth. And one of the great things about the racetrack in those days was it was also used as a fairground. Every fall, we'd have a fair, and endless cattle and pigs and so forth were brought here and put on exhibition for premiums. Well, we started having, of course, naturally, horse racing. And as time went on, we kept getting better horses, and the time got down. So for years, I can recall for years that if a race was won in around 2:30, it was considered a good race. And a horse that could go 2:30 and 2:35 was looked upon as a very valuable trotter. Well, of course, that went along for a number of years. And then, as a few fellows bought horses that were faster, and the whole racing picture was changed in Aroostook County when Presque Isle bought John R. Braden. Well, of course, John R. Braden would step a mile in 2:10 if he had to do it to win. Well, in running the fairs, and I was one of the directors and happened to be president of it, so I well remember when we had to sign notes to pay the premiums at the fairs. But anyway, unless we had one feature day that we got a mob, why, we were sure to go in debt. Well, to get a crowd on that feature day, we had to have a very fast race. Well, with John R. Braden at Presque Isle, Caribou and Holton and Woodstock, we all had to get busy and get horses that could race with him so as to have a feature free-for-all on that middle day of the fair when we planned to have an immense crowd. Well, of course, John R. Braden was a wonder horse, and he could go a mile in 2:05, and he was a perfect mannered horse. Well, of course, then they're getting down so that unless they won a race in at least 2:15, the public didn't think there was any race at all, so that really hurt the horse racing a lot. And the fairs sort of went, our fair here kind of died out due to the fact that the older fellas who would raise cattle, like Albert Moores and Oscar Shirley and a lot of them, had kind of got out of the idea of exhibiting cattle, and we had quite a time getting cattle. And so after a while, we cut the cattle part of it out, and our fairs were simply horse racing and so forth.
When was the track built up here on North Street?
That's right, too. In 96, the last of the so-called Putnam track here on North Street, that was built in 96. I can well remember when that was built, I was 16 years old, and what a kick I got out of. They'd have four and six horses on road machines, and very often they would let me get on and drive them. I thought that was a great accomplishment. I well remember one man, Albert Moores, came in from Ludlow with his nice pair of horses, and show you how times have changed. He worked on that park with that nice team for $3 a day. And that park was built, and it was in existence for years and years. And a lot of horse racing was done here. And the track, the grandstand, was in the edge of the grove right where my son Albert's house is. And the track went right down around just this side of what was the Ora Gilpatrick's home, and then went up North Street here, right where my house is, and went up to the so-called Michaud farm, and the upper end of the track was there. And I can remember so many times of Jeff Bradbury having a horse, and the first along the first of the park that went in the 20s, and he was considered a wonderful horse. But then we got to paying larger premiums, and that brought some better horses in here, and we used to have 3 and 4 days of great racing and wonderful horses and all, and what crowds we got. But that gradually died out as they got to having faster races at other places. And it's developed now that fairs like ours have passed out. The only 3 big fairs left now are Presque Isle, Bangor, and Skowhegan.
What can you tell us about the Holton Agricultural Society and the Holton Fair Association?
Well, as the Fair Association was kind of passing out, we formed the Holton Agricultural Society to take the fair over.
What year would that be?
It was, as I recall it, about 98 that the Agricultural Society took the fair over. Well, as usual, they promote older men who were the promoters of that. Well, just lost interest, and it was given up. Well, then, that left us high and dry. Well, then, of course, this park gradually closed, and it was Bolden Street was made, and we started, Father and Uncle Mel started selling house lots. Well, then later, there was a movement started, and there were 6 of us bought the so-called Tenney and Burley land there and held it for the fair, for a track to be built. Held it to turn over to the Agricultural Society, which we did. And we took little stock in the Agricultural Society. Is that for me? And then, finally, that is under the name of the Agricultural Society. Well, then, finally, we decided to abolish that and just had the owners of the track, the present Trotton Park. And as the interest in racing here kind of died out, it was always necessary for some local fellas to have a few horses and so forth, and we didn't have the local interest, we didn't get the crowd. And what really killed the Fair Association was that in the winter we'd have meetings and half the people in town would be there, and they were all very enthusiastic about, we must go ahead with the Fair Association. And about 8 or 10 of us, year after year, were elected directors of it. And I happened to be the goat and be president most of the time. Well, and I hate to admit it, but for years, the last few years of our fair and Trotton Association, we got fully as many people from Woodstock into the park as we got locally. People had cars then. Instead of going to the park, they'd take trips, which was what they wanted to do. Well, gradually, the whole thing just simply evaporated due to lack of attendance. And the last of the fair, we'd have to, of course, guarantee premiums. Well, when we didn't get money enough to pay the premiums, the directors would have to sign notes and put them in the bank. I well remember that. And then we'd have to have dances and I don't know what not to try to raise $3,000-$4,000 that we'd gone behind. And that way the fair just faded out.
Is that all right?
Good. Frank Station. And up in Monticello, we sold them 3 H International tractors. They were the big tractors then.
This is 1933.
33. Previous to that, and that was the Peabody's that had the John Deere and there was some, but I remember that. That was about the time the bigger tractors started. The bigger tractors that would take a disc harrow and all of those. So a lot of smaller tractors that really just about took the place of a pair of horses. See? And the Peabody's have always had a great machinery there. Jim Peabody started, and they've sold the Deere machinery. It's good. There was John Deere and the International and the Walt Gray Wood. But the International and John Deere up to within the last few years were the main tractors.
Which planters came first, the Evans, Robbins, or Aspinwall?
Well, as I recall it, and I think I'm right on this because they tried it on our land, Charles Parsons of Presque Isle brought an Evans planter here, and I well remember the day that he tried that out. Well, he sold a few of them, and then and I would say about 2 years after that, the Aspinwall planter appeared. Well, then, very shortly after that, the, what's the other
Robbins.
One? The Robbins planter appeared. And that was considered a very wonderful planter. A man rode on behind and watched the wheels as they went around distributing the seed, and if there was one missed, he dropped one in, and that did away with having any misses in the row. Of course, the Aspinwall and the Evans were picker planters. They revolving wheel that had these pointed arrangements, and they picked the seed up, and that way you got a very good. But the Aspinwall, they weren't touched by any equipment. All there was this flat arrangement with revolving wheels and pockets for seed. And the man riding on behind would watch those pockets. And if the one came around that didn't have a seed, he had one to drop in.
Was that the Aspinwall or the Robbins?
Robbins. That's the Robbins. Both, of course, both the Evans and Aspinwall did their own picking up. Well, then, of course, since that, there's been different planters developed, the John Deere and other kinds. But those are the early ones.
When did the Bangor and Aroostook Railroad first arrive in Holton?
Well, late in December in 92, the B&A had arrived the other side of the river, and they had got the bridge in coming in here, and the ties laid on the stringers of the bridge, on the stringers of the bridge. Well, then on Christmas Day in 92, as I recall it, they had a flat car and an engine, and in front of the flat car, they had a car, in front of the engine, they had a flat car loaded with the rails on it. Well, as they came across the bridge, they laid those rails, and that made it possible for the first train to come into Houghton. I well remember that because my brother Arthur and I, and Jimmy Donnelly, as I recall it, and a few other young fellows, we had gone over there in the morning, wallowed over there through the snow, and rode across on that flat car back of the engine, the first thing that came into Houghton. I'll never forget what a reception that those two engines, those two flat cars got then from the town. Of course, it was well advertised that was the first train in here, and it was. And it, why I remember so well, it was a stormy, cold day. I remember that. Well, then everything, Houghton thought we were saved. Yes?
It went along.
Well, now would I stay right?
Right on.
That feeling prevailed for 2 or 3 years until they decided to continue the railroad up north. Well, then people were quite upset. They thought that we wouldn't get half the business, and it meant a lot to us. But in the final analysis, they were pleased with it because our business increased here so much. And the first potato house built in Houghton was the one that built by Harris Porter. It's the house right back of what we call the Flat Watson House on Bangor Street. It's still in existence. It is owned by Harry Bass. That house was the first railroad potato house built in Aroostook County. The CP, up to that time, hadn't had any houses here. They shipped quite a number of cars of potatoes, but they were loaded right into the cars. At that time, most potato buyers didn't buy ahead. They would contract with the fellow to bring in a carload of potatoes, and they would do it. That's the way the business handled in those days. But after the B&A came in, and they got to building the potato houses. Well, shortly after that, Harris Porter built this one. Then the next year, he built the next one to it, and it went along then, and E.L. Cleveland Company, and Jalmer Redblack, and Win Blake, and several others started building potato houses, and those houses are still at the station here. And that was the way it was all up through the county.
What can you tell me about the Houghton Foundry?
Where is this here? The Houghton Foundry was between Bangor Street, right where the gas station is now. Between that and, what's the street?
Military
Street, right in the V there. And that was built by a man by the name of George Shea. He started in doing, in a small way, a lot of work for mills, making mill machinery and those things, and really equipping mills. Well, he got into farm machinery and so forth, and making wagons. He created quite a good thing when he made what they called the so-called jigger wagon. That was a wagon with a lower a bent axle on the rear, and it made the bodies right next, very near the ground. It made it so much easier to load the barrels of potatoes on that rather than the high wagons, and he became quite famous for that. Well, of course, his big business for years was making equipment for mills up the Ashland Branch and around. And then he came along and he made some farm machinery. He made a two-row horse hoe arrangement and so forth that sold by hundreds of them. And that went along, and that the foundry was very successful as long as Mr. Shea lived himself. But when he died, his two boys undertook to run it, but they were not mechanics like their father was, and in a few years they got discouraged and gave it up. And then it was closed and laid that way for quite a number of years. And then Putnam Brothers bought the building and all, for the sakes of getting the land. And at the present time, there's a nice golf station there.
Is that all?
Could you tell me where some of the livery stables were located in Holton and who owned them?
Okay. Well, there were several livery stables in Holton. As I look back upon them, one of the biggest ones was owned by Charlie McCluskey and his brother John. And that was right where the Holton Water Company are located now. There's a big barn there. Then there was a big barn connected with the Snell House that Jeff Bradbury had a lot of horses that he let and had some race horses. And just below that, there was one that Tabor, A.P.M. Tabor had, and he had a few. Then there was what they called the Exchange Stable. That was the stable back of the old Exchange Hotel. Well, Ole Buzzell owned the hotel, and he had this livery stable in back, and he had a lot of horses. And there were various others around town.
Was the one in the park, where Memorial Park is now, with the library?
Oh, yes. There was one that I have missed, one of the main ones, was Martin Lawless had one on Main Street, about where the monument is there now. And he used to have 30 or 40 horses let. And that went along until the big fire. Of course, the livery stable business had kind of died out due to cars, of course. But that big barn was there, and it burned the time of the big fire in 1902. But I wouldn't attempt to say. There must have been 10 or a dozen, anyway, various livery stables.
Is that all right?
So what is your question?
What kind of horse was best for farm work?
Well, any good-sized horse was good for farm work. But the one that was mostly, we used to have carload after carload of Western horses shipped in here. And they were mostly Persians. That was a good breed, and they were good size. And I remember, so many carloads of horses that came in here and were sold to farmers. And a farmer would want a horse that weighed from 1,500, really required for the heavy machinery, a horse that weighed from 1,500 to 1,800. And I was always greatly interested in horses, and I doubted for many years there was a carload of horses come in here that I didn't see them unload. Charlie Berry used to bring a lot of men. Previous to that, John Weiler had a store, a large barn on Mechanic Street, and he used to bring in for 20, 25 carloads of Western horses a year. Well, of course, eventually he died, and that stable was closed. But a horseman by the name of Irie Carpenter from Patton came over here, and he had bought Western horses and shipped them into Patton. Well, he changed his location to here. And I remember hearing Irish say that, well, that's my 30th car load of horses this year, and he'd have some after that. And a good, as I recall it, I remember my father paying $600 for a beautiful pair of black horses that weighed about 3,200, the pair. And anywhere from 1,500 to 1,800 was considered necessary.
What can you tell me about horse trading in Holton?
Well, that was quite a game back in the old days. There were swappers, as they called them. And, well, they'd swap and get a horse, and he might be 15 years old. By the time they filed his teeth and trimmed him up and so forth, why, he was about 5 years younger. And I well remember there was a Jewish fella came up here from Bangor buying rugs, and he'd been here quite a while. And you know, back in those days, there used to be truckmen. And there was a truckman by the name of Pickles. Well, we had the hardware store, and they all were parked right out front there. Well, this Jew traded horses with Pickles. Well, the horse he traded with Pickles had the heaves, but he had him dose, and so forth. Well, after that, we used to jolly. They used to hang around the store, more or less. We used to jolly this Jew about him trimming Pickles. Well, back in those days, three or four of us who'd been here in Holton were called up to court most every term as a witness to some local fellow that wanted to get naturalized. Well, I'll never forget this day, and this Jew was among them. Well, we were up in the courtroom, and the Jew sat with the candidates to be made citizens on the other side. Well, then, after the judge had passed the fella, he'd always say, "Does anyone in the courtroom know any reason why this man shouldn't become an American citizen?" And all of a sudden, my Jew friend jumped up and hollered clear across the courtroom. He says, "Now, Fred, when he asks that question about me, don't you tell him about me trimming Pickles." I'll never forget how that amused Judge Cornish. But that was a great trade in then. Another, there was a fellow...